nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, so the topic today is phonon scattering, and this is going to take, I'm not sure, a week or so to get through. So we won't get through it all today, but we'll get a good start on it. And next week we might finish, we might not. We'll see how things go. I don't have a good feeling. So it's phonon scattering one, and you'll see, I don't know, two, three, four, something like that. Oh, before we did that, I want to make a comment about last time. We talked about screening. You'll often hear screening in 2D or 1D is less effective than screening in 3D. And it's actually, it's a much more complicated problem. So let's say we have a wire or a sheet, and you have some charge perturbation, and you ask, what's the distance over which the perturbation is screened out? So there will be electric fields that will be going away, and the potential will decay exponentially. You could go through and use the formulas that we did, and you could compute a screening length in 2D or 3D, but the problem is really much more complicated than that, because the electric field lines can go out. The potential that's away is going to be influenced by these electric field lines that are going outside in the external environment. And typically, you're going to have other electrodes around and ground planes and everything, so you can't solve this problem unless you know what's close by and what are its potentials. You know, there may be a metal somewhere. If this is a 2D sheet and it's sitting on a wafer, a doped wafer maybe on top of an oxide, and that wafer is grounded, it's going to affect these field lines and have a big effect on what potential you see. So the field lines would maybe much more like to go down and to the ground plane or whatever. So I don't know if this is, if everybody uses this term. I call this geometric screening. It really depends more on the geometry of the electrodes that are nearby. And you can't solve the problem for what is the screening length unless you know what the environment is and where the electrodes are. So keep that in mind if you're doing screening in other dimensions. So the topic today is phonons. So first of all, we have to talk a little bit. We're not going to talk much about phonons. I hope you all take a solid-state physics course, and you've either seen this before or you should see a proper treatment of phonons. We're going to talk about just enough so that we can do the calculations and it makes sense to us. Okay, so think of this mass on in a spring problem. You've probably done this in freshman physics. We've got this mass. We pull it down. We let it oscillate. It oscillates back and forth at a frequency. So it's a relatively easy problem to solve. You know, the potential energy of this spring is 1/2 times the spring constant times the deviation from equilibrium squared. Right? Or if I want the force that's being exerted, I just take minus the derivative of the energy. So force is minus kx. And x naught is the resting position. So if I pull it, I'll have a force in one direction. If I push it up, I'll have a force in another direction. Force is mass times acceleration. So I can write a little differential equation for how x varies with time. And you'll find that it oscillates. It's a harmonic oscillator. It oscillates at some frequency. And the frequency is the square root of spring constant divided by m. So these are... But this is a classical approach. You know, any harmonic oscillator, when you treat it quantum mechanically, the energy levels are quantized. And this is one of the standard problems that you treat in quantum mechanics. Classically, you'd say that the energy is proportional to the amplitude squared of the vibration. Quantum mechanically, it's proportional to n plus 1/2 times h bar omega. So n is some integer. And we have this zero-point motion. The smallest the energy can be is 1/2 h bar omega. And then it can increase in discrete units above that. So we're going to treat phonons classically, and then we're going to put the quantum mechanics in at the end. If you take a quantum mechanics course, which you should do, you probably have seen or will see the quantum theory of the harmonic oscillator, and that's the right way to do the problem. But we're going to take some shortcuts so that we can get the right answers here. Okay, so if you think about a solid material, you know, there are these forces between the atoms that hold everything together, and there's some lattice constant A. If I pull the atoms away, they want to come back to their natural lattice spacing, just due to all of the core atomic potentials and things. If I push them together, there's a spring force that pushes me out. So there is some potential energy, and I could, at the minimum, we're right at the lattice constant. And if I do a Taylor series expansion around the minimum, it's going to look parabolic to the first order. So I can think of these as springs with some spring constant. So, you know, at a finite temperature, there's going to be some thermal energy and all of these things are moving. So I would expect to see wave solutions in, you know, this is a classic problem. We can just formulate the equations of motion just like I did for the mass on the spring. It's just that we've got a spring to the left and a spring to the right. And now we could ask, you know, what is the displacement of an atom at some particular location? And you could set up Newton's equations and solve that. And you would find that the solutions are oscillating in time as e to the I omega t. But since we have an array of this, we're going to get waves. They can propagate in the x direction. So the solutions are going to have some amplitude A. There's going to be an e to the I beta x. Beta is the wave vector, so we're propagating in the x direction. And they'll be oscillating in time, omega t. All right. Now, there's also a polarization. The displacement can be along the x direction, if that's the direction of propagation, but it also can be normal. It can be in the y direction, or it can be out of the page. So we have three different possible polarizations. Right. So if you have a solid-state physics course, this is a classic problem. When you start phonons, you start here, you set up the equations of motion, and you solve these equations. And you find the properties. So for example, if I say, let me look at the displacements that are in the longitudinal direction. Right. Then I get a solution, and we will find that the frequency omega depends on the wave vector. That gives us a dispersion. So these are waves in a periodic media, just like the electron block waves are waves in a periodic media. So we're going to get periodic solutions. We're going to have Brillouin zones. Same thing is going to happen. I could reduce everything to the first Brillouin zone. They're going to repeat periodically because it's a periodic system. And when you solve this, you'll get omega as a function of beta, and you'll get characteristics that look like this when the displacement is in the x direction. These are called longitudinal acoustic phonons. Propagating in the x direction, each atom is displaced in the x direction. And a characteristic feature is that if you go down to the long wavelength limit, small wave vector, then omega is proportional to k. And the ratio of omega divided by k is the propagation velocity of the wave. And that's what we call the sound velocity, because these are the kind of oscillations. You know, when I'm speaking here and giving oscillations in the atmosphere out to you, those are longitudinal acoustic waves, and it's the same kind of wave that's propagating in a solid here. So that's the sound velocity of the solid, omega over beta. But you can see it gets complicated and it goes to zero at the zone boundary. If you look at the actual displacements near the origin, what's happening in this kind of oscillation is that one atom is displaced to the right, the next atom has a smaller magnitude, it's displaced to the right but by less. The next atom is displaced even a little bit less. So that's like the positive half of the cycle. Then you turn around in the negative half of the cycle and the displacement is in the opposite direction. Then the magnitude of the displacement increases and it's displaced more in the opposite direction and even more. And you just have this oscillation. The displacements are along the direction of propagation. And you can solve this problem. It's not hard to solve at all. You get this dispersion. It depends on the spring constants, you know, and the velocity of sound. You can also find just by differentiating this. Take d omega dk for small beta. Sine beta a is beta a over 2 for small beta. You know, expand it down here, you get the sound velocity. Now, normally in a solid, you know, we don't think directly of the mass of the atom and the lattice spacing a. We think of things like the mass density rho, the density per cubic centimeter, and then the spring constant. So if I just bring this A inside the square root and convert my mass to a mass per unit volume of the unit cell, in a normal material, the sound velocity will be square root of C sub L divided by rho. C sub L is like the spring constant. It's the elastic constant of the material, something we can look up. Rho is like the mass. It's the mass density. I think for silicon, it's about silicon propagating in 100 direction. It's something like 8 times 10 to the 5th centimeters per second. Most materials, it's somewhere in the range of 5 times 10 to the 5th centimeters per second, less than 10 to the 6th, somewhere in that range. So what do we compare that with? You know, what's, you know, is that fast or is it slow? So we should compare it with something. And what you'd probably want to compare it with is what's the average velocity of an electron? Because we're going to have electrons and photons scattering, and it would be helpful to know how their velocities compare. So what's the average velocity of an electron?
And it's about
10 to the 7.
Yeah. You know, the drift velocity can be very much less, but the average thermal velocity that they're going around, that is something like 10 to the 7th. So these sound velocities, these phonons, are moving much, much slower than the typical electron at room temperature. That'll be important to know later on. Okay, we have others. You know, we could ask, well, what happens if the displacement is in the y direction? So these are transverse acoustic phonons. So here one is displaced a lot at the left, then its neighbor is displaced less, and then its neighbor is displaced even less, and then this sine wave goes in the opposite direction, and the displacement is down, and then it's down even more, and then it's down even more. So we can get solutions where the displacement looks like this. Again, they're called acoustic. Like you'll see in a minute, the acoustic modes, the displacement of each atom is, you know, adjacent atoms are displaced in the same direction, except for these points where you go through a node, right? Okay, so we have two of those in 3D, right? There can be one coming out of the page, and there can be one going, like I've sketched here, in the y direction. The spring constants might be a little different in that direction because we're displacing in a different direction. So we have three acoustic phonon branches, right? And we can compute the dispersion for these, and you know, they're well known and looked up. Okay, but that's not all we have. Most of these materials have 2 atoms per unit cell, and frequently, like in a material like gallium arsenide, those 2 atoms will have different masses. And then you can have a different set of modes. You know, you can have oscillations that behave a little differently. So here we have a small atom and a big atom. So let's say this is one unit cell, and they have 2 different masses. If it's silicon, there are 2 atoms in a unit cell of silicon. They just have the same mass. But that we can have the same kind of modes in silicon also. So the key point is that if we've got 2 in the unit cell, we can have a different type of oscillation. So in a longitudinal optic phonon, these 2 atoms in the unit cell will oscillate 180 degrees out of phase. If one is displaced to the right, the adjacent one in the unit cell is displaced to the left. So now we think of this oscillation in the first unit cell, the displacement magnitude is big, but each of the 2 are displaced against each other. This is near beta, near the origin. In the next unit cell, they're still displaced against each other, but the magnitude of the displacement is smaller. In the next one, it's smaller yet. If my screen were longer, it would change sign and they would be pulled apart, and then they would be pulled apart more. So this is what we would call a longitudinal optical phonon. They're called optical because they have the right frequencies that they interact with light. That's what the term optical comes along with. The other ones are called acoustic because they're similar to sound waves, normal sound waves. So the key point is that the two atoms oscillate out of phase. Right? And if you haven't seen this before, you know, this is something that you want a good introduction to solid state physics course where you go through properties of phonons very carefully and you get comfortable with this. I'm just giving you some key features that we're going to use. All right, now we could also have transverse optic, meaning they're displaced in opposite directions, but they're displaced normal to the direction of propagation. Yes?
For the case of acoustic phonon, is this vibration for unit cell? I mean, if you consider two atoms as a unit cell, then among this, the vibration will be considered as acoustic phonon, is it right?
The vibration?
Yeah, the vibration between the unit cells, is it considered as acoustic phonon or it is only between the two atoms?
Well, I mean, the vibration is propagating through the entire crystal. So, you know, there will be a sine wave that will give the magnitude of the oscillation. If I look at any point, if the magnitude is high, and I look at that unit cell, it means that the two atoms in the unit cell are being displaced against each other by a large magnitude, right?
So this is for optical phonon, right? Inside the unit cell.
Yeah.
But what about this acoustic phonon?
Well, they're there also. There are all of these modes that can be happening simultaneously, right? And, you know, you can decompose. So the atoms are moving in some way. If you you can decompose them into the normal modes. And the basic modes of oscillations are these. You know, longitudinal acoustic, transverse acoustic, longitudinal optic, transverse optic. We can decompose the complicated motion of these into these normal modes. And what we're showing you here are the normal modes. So all of this is happening at the same time.
Why I'm asking is because in a unit cell, I can consider these two atoms as a reduced mass concept. And I can consider it as a single atom having some reduced mass. And then between these two cells, or between these two unit cells, I can consider the vibration which is purely acoustic or not.
Okay, I think I'm having a hard time to understand the exact question. But maybe we can discuss it afterwards and I can see if I can get a little clearer about what you're asking. Okay, so, you know, what we're describing here are what would be called the normal modes of the system. You know, they're the basic independent ways that the crystals can oscillate. You know, really in the thermal vibration, they're all oscillating in some complicated way, but you could decompose them into these normal mode components if you weight each of the components by some factor, then you can describe what's happening to the actual structure. Okay, so these are optical phonons. Optical because in the unit cell, they're displaced in opposite directions, but now they're transverse to the direction that the wave is propagating. All right, so there are going to be two of those. So if you plot the dispersions of that mode, it has this characteristic feature that it doesn't depend very much on frequency. The wave vector and frequency is much flatter. The energies are much higher, right? The energy is going to be h bar omega. The energies are much higher, and they're close to optical energies of electromagnetic radiation that's in the optical regime, and that's why they're called optical phonons. They can interact with light can interact with these phonons, but it doesn't change very much from the center to the end. Okay, so in general, you know, depending on the material parameters, we have acoustic modes where adjacent atoms vibrate in the same direction. We have optical modes where they vibrate against each other. And the specifics here of exactly the numbers and where they might meet. For example, if you have a nonpolar semiconductor, you find that these transverse and longitudinal optical modes are degenerate at beta equals zero. If you have a nonpolar semiconductor, you find that the longitudinal optical and the longitudinal acoustic meet at the zone boundary. So You know, these are all of the things that you learn in more detail if you take a solid state physics course. And people can measure these things with techniques like Raman scattering, where you interact with light and things. And I'd like to, I'm not sure I have the best example of this. We could probably find a better one on the web somewhere. But these are measured dispersion coefficients, characteristics of phonons in silicon. I believe they're measured. And you see, they're being plotted along various high symmetry points in the Brillouin zone. But gamma is at beta equals zero. X is along the 100 direction. So you can see the transverse and acoustic modes here. You can see the optical modes here, and you can see the longitudinal optical mode meeting the longitudinal acoustic mode at the zone boundary. You know, that's characteristic of a nonpolar semiconductor. And let's see, I didn't label this one. I think this one is gallium arsenide. And again, you see the transverse acoustic modes. You see the longitudinal acoustic modes. You see the optical modes now, and whereas in the silicon they're degenerate at zero wave vector, in gallium arsenide they're not. Whereas in silicon, the longitudinal optic and the transverse and the longitudinal acoustic met at the zone boundary. In a polar semiconductor, they don't. Okay. So these are things that people know a lot about. Just like they know a lot about band structure of materials, people know a lot about dispersion characteristics of phonons, and you know, they're things that there are well-established techniques to compute and that you can look up. Yes?
What's the physical meaning of this intersection between the longitudinal acoustic and optical phonons in silicon and not in gallium arsenide?
What's the meaning of the intersection?
Is there any physical? Because they are different, right? In silicon, they intersect. That gives us a different property. Which property is based on that intersection?
Oh, so, you know, why are these different in silicon and...
Why is silicon the intersecting silicon, right? But they don't intersect in gallium arsenide.
Yeah. Yeah, and, I don't know what the simple... If there is a simple answer to that, we'd have to talk much more about these dispersion characteristics and where they come from, and the fact that in silicon we have identical masses of atoms in a unit cell. In gallium arsenide we have different masses of the unit cell. Gallium arsenide is also polar. There's a dipole moment between these two atoms in the unit cell. That affects the phonon dispersion characteristics. And, you know, apparently some of those details are responsible for the fact that they're no longer meeting at the zone boundary. So I can't do justice to this in this lecture. This is why I'm encouraging. You know, there's a lot about phonons that you want to understand. Now, we're not going to deal with dispersion characteristics like this. Some people do when they do scattering rate calculations. When they want to be careful, they do it numerically. They will take a full numerically generated dispersion characteristic, just like they'll take a full numerically generated E of K for the electrons and do all the calculations numerically. We're going to grossly simplify it. And actually, it's the typical thing that people use for most semiconductor work when you're doing scattering rate calculations. We're going to find, here in a minute, we'll find that it's the longitudinal modes that couple most strongly with the phonons. So those are the ones we're going to worry about. If we're just scattering electrons around within a valley, we're only changing the wave vector by a small amount. So it's going to be the phonons near beta equals zero that are going to be the ones that are important to us. And near beta equals zero, the longitudinal acoustic is linear. Nice, simple dispersion characteristic. All we need to know is the sound velocity of the material. Near the zone boundary, the longitudinal optical one is almost flat. So in that regime, we just say omega is independent of beta, and all we need to know is the optical phonon energy. Something like 36 millielectron volts for gallium arsenide, and I think it's bigger for silicon, 60 or something. So we can get by with a very simple description. Now, we also worry about silicon has these six valleys, And some of the scattering processes are going to move electrons from one of those valleys to another. Then you're moving large distances in momentum. That's going to take phonons that are near the zone boundary. And there it could be either an optical or acoustic phonon. People will talk about intervalley phonons. There is no such thing as an intervalley phonon. There are only optical and acoustic phonons. But the particular one that's responsible for scattering from one valley to another are sometimes called intervalley phonons. And out there near the boundary, we're going to need a phonon that's near the edge of the Brillouin zone. We're just going to assume that the dispersion is about constant there, because if I need a big one near the edge of the Brillouin zone, I don't have to worry about the fact that it's changing. And there'll be some frequency there that will be responsible for scattering me from the initial valley to the final valley. So this is the kind of phonon dispersion that we're going to use when we do calculations. Okay, now I should mention one other thing here about, let's look at the amplitude of the vibration, because we're going to need this more carefully later on. We have an oscillation that goes as e to the I beta x minus omega t. Okay, I mean, it's a real oscillation. So what we really mean, it's the real part of that. Right? Because this thing is oscillating. It's being displaced in time. It's not a complex number. So, the real displacement is magnitude times cosine beta a j. So a is a lattice spacing, j is an integer. So this just takes me from one lattice spacing to another. So this is the displacement at location x sub j. And then the frequency dependent omega sub beta reminds me that there is a dispersion characteristic. Omega depends on beta. All right. So if I differentiate this, I find the velocity that this is oscillating at, du dt. The kinetic energy, if I want to know, this thing is oscillating in time and moving about at some speed. If I want to find the kinetic energy, it's 1/2 mass of that atom times the magnitude of the velocity squared. And then if I want the average kinetic energy, this is oscillating sinusoidally in time. So I'm going to take the average value of sine squared over one period. And then I'll get the average kinetic energy over that period. The average value of sine squared over one period is 1/2, and I already had a 1/2. So the kinetic energy is 1/4 the mass of the atom times the amplitude squared times frequency squared. So classically, on any of these, mass on spring things, you expect the energy to be proportional to the amplitude squared. Just like in an EM wave, the energy density is proportional to the electric field squared. Right? Now, you might remember when doing these kind of things that the average kinetic energy, if I had done the calculation for the average potential energy, remember, we have this U is equal to kx minus x naught squared. So there's potential energy and there's kinetic energy, and it's always oscillating back and forth between the two. Sometimes all of the energy is kinetic energy and none is potential. Then when it oscillates up and stops, then all of the energy is potential energy and none is kinetic. But if I take the time average value over one period, they're equal. The average kinetic energy over a period is equal to the average potential energy over a period. So I have two of these, so I multiply by two. So the average total energy, kinetic plus potential, is 1/2 m amplitude of a squared omega squared. Okay. Now I just have to put, where do I do it? All right, I'm not going to put anything in yet here. It's going to be more convenient for me not to think about the mass of the individual atoms, but to think about the mass density rho. So I'll replace the mass of the atom by rho times the volume that I'm doing the calculation over times the mass density rho. So this is what we have for the average total energy. Now we put quantum mechanics in. We're not doing a proper treatment, quantum mechanical treatment of the harmonic oscillator, but we know everything is quantized quantum mechanically. The energy is going to be quantized in units of h bar omega. So I have to equate that to h bar omega. And then later on, we're going to multiply by the number of phonons. So if I just take this classical result and if I equate it to h bar omega, I replace the amplitude squared with 2h bar over rho over omega, rho, capital omega, rho for mass density, little omega for frequency. Okay. So now I've got an expression for this lattice vibration that it's a wave propagating in the x direction at a frequency omega, and I've got the amplitude right such that when I compute the energy of this classical vibration, it's going to give me the answer that quantum mechanics says that it has to have. So we're sort of putting in quantum mechanics after the fact. Okay. When we calculate the scattering rates, we're going to be using this. All right. We'll see how far we get today. We may have a few lectures on electron-phonon coupling. So, you know, that's just enough about phonons so that we can understand what's going on and do the calculations. Okay. Now we have to talk about how phonons and electrons are coupled. So, you know, the electrons are there. We're interested in the electron transport. The phonons are vibrations of the lattice. You know, how are the two coupled? The two have to be coupled if there's a scattering event. You know, we have to figure out what that coupling is. And one of the most important coupling, or the one that people usually begin with, is called deformation potential coupling. So it's a fact that if you take a semiconductor, you take any solid material and you squeeze it, you'll change the band gap. You know, because the band gap depends on the lattice spacing. And you know, when you push things together, then the bands came from the atomic orbitals initially, and when you push them together, they sort of spread out. You know, when you do a perturbation problem quantum mechanically, the energy levels want to spread out when you bring them together. So you squeeze it together, the band gap changes, right? People have equipment, you know, where they do this. This is a big part of, it's a big part of why silicon technology has worked so well in the last few years. You know, most silicon technology now is strained silicon technology, where they're intentionally straining the silicon to change its band structure. So this is something that's well established. You can look up these deformation potentials. People compute them from first principles. The entire band gap changes. So if there's some fractional change in the lattice spacing, then there's some change in the band gap. And the constant D is called the deformation potential. You've deformed the lattice. You know, both the conduction band and the valence band are moving. It's not just the band gap is changing. Part of that change comes because the conduction band moved up. Part of the change came because the valence band moved down. So there are really two separate deformation potentials. There's one for the conduction band and there's one for the valence band. Okay. So we have this wave going through and it's displacing the lattice, so it's changing the lattice spacing, meaning the band gap, or the conduction band edge and the valence band edge, they're spatially varying in the lattice because of this phonon wave propagating through. So if you look at what the change in lattice spacing is for these acoustic modes, you're moving everything in the same direction, so you're not directly making a big change in lattice spacing. One atom moves to the right, the next atom moves to the right. The lattice spacing hasn't changed. But the nature of the oscillation is that the magnitude of the displacement from atom to atom is changing a little bit. So one atom moves a lot, the next one doesn't move quite as much, so now they're a little bit closer together. If they're a little bit closer together, the band gap has changed. So if I want to know what the change in lattice spacing is, I could take the displacement at location x, and I could subtract the displacement at its nearest neighbor. I could use a Taylor series expansion for the displacement at the nearest neighbor and just say that that's the derivative of the displacement with respect to position times A, which is how far away that neighbor is. So we're left to conclude that the change in lattice spacing is du dx times the lattice spacing. So it's not, the change in lattice spacing isn't proportional to the displacement, it's proportional to the gradient of the displacement. That's what people call strain, right? So it's not proportional to u, it's proportional to du. So that means that when the electron comes through, and the lattice has been strained, and the conduction band is a little bit higher than it's supposed to be, it might reflect off of that. That's the electron-phonon coupling. That's where it comes from. Right? There's been a local change in the band gap. The electron is going to scatter off of that local change in band gap. So our scattering potential is this perturbation in the conduction band edge, and that is just going to be directly proportional to the fractional change. The constant of proportionality is something that we call the deformation potential for the conduction band. If we're doing holes, we'd have a number that might be a little different, deformation potential for holes. So this is what we call deformation potential scattering. Okay. And let's take a look at it a little more. So it's a constant times the strain. The lattice vibration is some wave, plane wave, that's propagating. If I take its spatial derivative, I pull down an I beta. Isn't going to matter whether I have plus or minus, because in the end, Fermi's golden rule only wants a magnitude of U squared, matrix element squared. So I end up with my deformation, my scattering potential, after I take this gradient, being basically plus or minus I beta acoustic deformation potential, should be the same one up here, times U. So now I get a scattering potential that's proportional to U, just because this was a wave that I differentiated. I'm going to call that case of beta. So bottom line, we have deduced the electron-phonon coupling parameter for acoustic phonons. And what's going to matter when I do my calculation is always the magnitude squared. So magnitude of k beta squared is just beta squared times this deformation potential squared. All right, that's an important scattering mechanism. Now, the other thing, we won't spend much time on this. If you look at the transverse acoustic modes, they're not displacing the atoms in the x direction. They're displacing them in an orthogonal direction. And you do a little bit of geometry, and you'll find that to first order, they're not changing the lattice spacing. To second order, they are. But to first order, there's no change in lattice spacing for the transverse modes. So for that reason, we usually begin by just ignoring the transverse modes and saying the electron phonon scattering is going to occur from the acoustic modes because they're directly changing the lattice spacing, which is directly changing the band gap. Okay, now if you look at the optical phonons, you know, here things are much stronger because adjacent atoms or in the unit cell are being displaced against each other. So here I don't have to rely on a strain, on a difference of displacements. It's, you know, the two atoms themselves are being pushed against each other, so the displacement itself is changing that distance, and therefore it's changing the band gap. So here I can see that the change in lattice spacing is directly proportional or is directly equal to the amplitude of the vibration, and the amplitude of the vibration is this plane wave. So here I'm just going to, you know, people try to compute these and justify them. You know, it turns out it's a little harder to justify than the acoustic modes, but we're going to treat this as an empirical parameter, and we'll just call it the optical deformation potential. So for optical phonon scattering, it's occurring by deformation potential, which means change of lattice spacing that's changing the band gap. The coupling coefficient is just this optical deformation potential squared. Okay. Now, you know, and this looks like it's all we're going to get through here today. What happens in polar semiconductors? A polar semiconductor, like gallium arsenide, the two atoms in the unit cells come from different columns of the periodic table. So the bond here has some polar nature. There's a little bit of a transfer of charge. Arsenic is column 5, so it's got 5 electrons. Gallium is column 3, so it's got 3. So there's a little bit of a charge transfer between the extra electrons in arsenic to the deficit of electrons in gallium. So there's a dipole that gets set up. Right? There's a dipole moment. So there are optical modes here. There is optical deformation potential, But there is another scattering potential that's so much stronger that we never worry about optical deformation potential scattering in polar materials. And that comes about because of this little dipole moment. So that dipole moment is going to give me an electrostatic interaction that's going to scatter carriers very strongly. So that's the one I'm going to worry about. Now, you might remember in 604 that one of the prime quantities that you look at when you're relating D and E is the dipole moment per unit volume. That's what we'll call capital P. So I need to take this little dipole moment here, and I need to divide by the volume of the unit cell, and then I've got dipole moment per unit volume. Now, it's the delta here. It's only the delta that matters. You know, this dipole is there to begin with, and when you do the band structure calculations, it's been included in the band structure calculations. That's why we get the band structure of gallium arsenide that we do. But now it's the oscillation in that dipole, it's the change from its nominal value that's going to become a scattering potential. So it's the delta P that I'm worried about. Okay, so we have this expression, displacement field is equal to epsilon naught E plus dipole moment per unit volume. Well, you've seen this in 604. We're only interested in the change because the other part has already been included in our when we calculated the band structure. So we're interested in delta E, D and how it's related to the change in E and the change in P. Okay. Now, if there's no net charge has been added here, so there's no free charge that's been added between this dipole, so divergence of delta D is equal to zero. If you take divergence of this plane wave, you'll see that that implies that the magnitude of delta D itself is zero. So we're going to put a zero on the left-hand side here, and then I can solve for the electric field. And then I can integrate the electric field, and I can find the scattering potential. So the electric field is minus the change in dipole moment per unit volume divided by epsilon naught. And I can relate that to the individual one. The scattering potential, I just integrate that electric field. And it means I just have to integrate that electric field over distance. And I'll integral of E dot dx gives me a voltage multiplied by Q, and I get an energy. So this is the scattering potential that's deflecting the electron in a polar semiconductor. It's this. All right, so we have this little dipole moment. It's some effective charge times a displacement. So you displace it a little bit. You know, dipole moment is charge times the distance between the plus and minus ends of the dipole. So the distance is the displacement, UB, the optical phonon. Displaced it a little bit. Q star is the effective charge. You know, we haven't transferred one complete electron from the arsenic to the gallium. It's just some fraction that's been transferred. I think in gallium arsenide, it's like 0.2 Q, right? So that's the charge. So that means if I use that effective charge for my dipole moment in this expression, if I do the integral of this plane wave, I'm going to bring down a 1 over I beta when I do that integral. So that depends, that goes on the bottom. Now, here's something, you know, you can find it worked out in several references, but people usually don't quote. If you go to a book and try to look up what the effective charge is, it's a little hard to find that. The way people usually write this effective charge is in terms of two parameters that are easy to measure. And that's the relative dielectric constant at low frequency and at high frequency. And that is a measure of the effective charge. If you measure it at low frequency, then everything can respond, and you know this dipole moment is part of the dielectric constant that you measure. If you measure it at high frequency, things are oscillating so fast that this dipole moment can't respond to the optical signal, and you measure a smaller dielectric constant. The difference between those two is related to this effective charge. So you usually see this expression related like this. Low field dielectric constant divided by dielectric constant at high frequency minus 1. In silicon, these two are the same. So this is zero. There's no dipole moment there. But in polar materials, these are numbers that you can look up. Okay, so that means our scattering potential, we just relate this effective charge to these low and high frequency dielectric constants, and then our scattering potential. We just lump everything into a set of terms called K beta, and we get an expression that looks like this. All right. Now, this is really, this is important, because this is the dominant scattering mechanism in gallium arsenide. And you'll notice there's a beta squared downstairs. Now, last lecture we talked about ionized impurity scattering. And, you know, so this, when we see that beta squared downstairs, we immediately recognize something. We recognize that if you have a small deflection, you're going to have a small beta. And small beta means you're going to have a very strong coupling constant. Small angle deflections are going to be strongly preferred, which is completely expected, because this is an electrostatic interaction, just like the ionized impurity scattering was an electrostatic interaction. All electrostatic interactions have a preference for small angle deflections. So this is a scattering mechanism that is anisotropic. It prefers small angle deflections. And it's inelastic because it's an optical phonon energy that has an energy of like 30 MeV, you know, comparable to an average electron. So it is both inelastic and isotropic, which means the relaxation time approximation doesn't work. All right, I won't go through this one. There are also acoustic phonons in polar materials. They will also change the lattice spacing, and therefore change the dipole constant. They don't change it as strongly, because here you have to rely on the strain. You know, both are being displaced in the same direction. It's just the neighbor is being displaced a little bit more or less than the one we're looking at. So it's a weaker mechanism. It's called piezoelectric scattering, and I think it's discussed in the book and in one of the homework problems in the back of the book. So here's about where we're going to end today. For each of these scattering mechanisms, acoustic deformation potential, optical deformation potential, piezoelectric, which is the last one I talked about, which only becomes important in polar materials at low temperature, and polar optical phonon, which is the one that you think of first if you have any polar material, we've been able to deduce what the electron phonon coupling constants are. Now we can do the calculations. Now, there are lots of scattering mechanisms that we aren't going to have time to talk about. A few of them are in the book, but you know, when you read papers, there are neutral impurities. In alloys, you have different scattering mechanisms. At surfaces or at edges of graphene ribbons, you have other types of scattering mechanisms. The electron gas itself can oscillate collectively, and you can excite plasmon oscillations. One electron can scatter off of another electron. One electron can scatter off of a hole. You know, there's probably at least a half a dozen other scattering mechanisms that can occur in principle. But you would do the same kind of thing. You would look at the physics of the mechanism and try to figure out what the physics of the coupling mechanism was, and then you would try to deduce an electron coupling mechanism for that particular mechanism, and then you would put it in Fermi's golden rule. Okay. Is there one question?
Yeah, which one is the elastic scattering?
So, yeah, I only got partway through today's lecture. Why don't we start there? And, you know, some of these, neutral impurity is elastic, alloy scattering is elastic. I'm going to argue on Monday that acoustic phonon scattering near room temperature is close to elastic. Polar optical phonon scattering we can never think of as elastic. Yeah. Okay, so it looks like we will continue this discussion on Monday.